And this is KBOO Portland. We're creeping up on 11 a.m. when it will be time for Pacific Underground, which, as mentioned before, is a program for and by the Asian and Pacific Islander communities in the Northwest. With so few media outlets making space for such voices, how does KBOO manage to do it? Well, it's due mostly to the support of the audience. That's right. The listeners pay all the bills. As we know, any entity like KBOO is accountable to those who pay its bills. So KBOO makes sure that it's the listeners that pay the bills, making it accountable to the listeners. And when that happens, there's room for stuff like this. Stay tuned.
Hey, remember this song? We knew you would. Or, in case you're 8 years old or don't watch movies, this is an iconic song from the 1961 film adaptation of the Broadway musical West Side Story. You know, the Jets versus Sharks, Officer Krumke, racial tension in the Upper West Side of New York. From this musical, the scene, actually, we're about to enter into a key moment of the Asian American movement. My aunt, actually, Nobuko Miyamoto, who, yes, is decidedly Japanese American and not Puerto Rican, can be seen on screen during the scene, playing one of Maria's friends, responding to Maria's rhetorical questions. What mirror, where? Nobuko grew up dancing professionally, singing, and acting, which early in her career landed her the role in West Side Story. City should give me its key. A committee should be organized to honor me. La, 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 la. Unbeknownst to her at that point, about a decade later, she would begin touring the United States in the first ever all-Asian American band, performing songs about racism, imperialism, and gathering momentum to help spread the unsung struggle for racial justice that was just beginning to take shape in Asian communities around the nation. This month, we're talking about resistance through art, and taking a look at the story of one person whose experience cracked the mold of Asian stereotypes that so many seem to just accept. But we'll come back to Nobuko. You're listening to Pacific Underground. We're a collective of Asian Americans that produce this show out of the blindingly white Portland, Oregon, to give a modest, but by no means complete, voice to Asian American lives, culture, and struggles. But it's a voice nonetheless. And my name's Kanan Schlesinger. I'll be the disembodied voice guiding you through the hour, whether you like it or not. This month, we got the idea of talking to Nobuko when a friend of ours recreated an historic moment from Nobuko's heyday when she drew a black and white ink poster. She posted a picture of it on social media, and we took the bait. This is Amisa Chu.
I felt like my Japanese identity was being stripped from me, so I decided to do a hyphen. So I met this young girl in Atlanta, and we became really close, and her name was Asante, with a apostrophe Santi. And then, as like kind of a homage to her, I changed my name to like A apostrophe Misa, which is like An apostrophe Misa, basically. Like, it's combining my first and middle names together.
Great.
So I created an art name out of my two names, just because I got rid of my middle name, like, officially in terms of my legal name now. So my legal name is An Matsushima Chu. I grew up with such a long name that when I got rid of Matsushima, I was like, oh, I got rid of so many syllables. my parents named me Misa Ann when I was born. And then I was Misa for like 2 weeks. And then my dad got a kind of a racist comment from a coworker. And he was like, how's that little miso soup doing? And then he was like, oh no, everyone's going to call her miso. And then they changed it. They flipped it.
Oh my God.
So that was another, reason that I reclaimed it. Because I was like, I was supposed to be Misa in the first place.
Oh my God, who would say, what a jerk.
Yeah, so there's multi-layers to that story.
Misa is a prominent zinester in Portland. That's zinester, not scenester, just in case. Who has recently taken upon herself to dive into the annals of Asian Americanness to make a big moment of our story better known. Here's Misa again.
So it is a black and white illustration of Nobuko Miyamoto and Chrissy Jima singing in a mic, and the text bubble above them, like comic style, it says, we are the offspring of the concentration camps. And that's directly linking to lyrics of a song that they have, Yellow Pearl, where that's one of the opening lines in the opening paragraph of the song. And they're definitely coming from a time of the Vietnam War, protesting the Vietnam War and the rise and creation of the Asian American movement.
To find the roots of the Asian American, or as it's sometimes called, the Pan-Asian movement, we don't need to look too far back in time. This hyphenated racial label that we've had really little choice but to adopt is actually less than 50 years in the making. Let's jump back in time, back into Nobuko's life, before the identity label Asian American even came into use, back when what are now cringeworthy words like Oriental or straight-up racial epithets were more common. Nobuko spent most of her first years interned during World War II, and when she and her family got out, they moved around to the West Coast, to Idaho, and then her father eventually got a job in Utah, where she discovered dance.
Well, first of all, it's interestingly mixed up together, because I'm a child of Japanese internment, or the Japanese concentration camps. So I experienced that as a very young child, and it was a very lost young child, being moved from place to place to place in strange, you know, environments. And my father was a lover of classical music. So when we did get out, finally, we were in first in Idaho, and then we moved to Ogden, Utah, where he got a job. We're originally from California. So my father took me to Salt Lake City to a huge concert of classical music. And when I heard this music, I was 4 years old. It just took me into a different world. And I felt like this was, from being a lost child, from being feeling just overwhelmed by all this other stuff, that this was a place of beauty, a place of, in a sense, empowerment, yes, because one's emotions could be fully expressed. And feel moved and be moved. And so when I started dancing to this music, pulling out his records and dancing to it, my mother saw this, and because she was also a frustrated artist, she said, let's find some dancing lessons for you. So she took me to a little dance school, and that's how, at 4 years old, I became involved in the arts. And it was a sense of liberation. Of course, I didn't know, have any political, you know, background or anything. And my mother was really the one, when we returned to Los Angeles, I had piano lessons. And then at seven, I started seriously dancing. And I just loved it so much. So she was the one that allowed me and found good dance schools and showed me pictures of the great ballerinas, some of whom, or a few of whom, were Alicia Alonso from Cuba, Ruth Ann Kuo-sin, who was an exceptional Korean-American a Native American dancer. Her name was Maria Talchi, and a half, I think, Sono Osato, who was half Japanese and half Irish. So she showed me these images and sort of inspired me that, oh, I can do this too. So it put me on a path at a very young age of really striving with good education, with good training. So by the time I was 15, I got my first job in a movie called King and I. Now, it's interesting because King and I is a movie about, when I reflect back on it, it's a movie about this great figure, this king of Siam, but this white woman is influencing and wants to influence him to be a better, more democratic king. And in times when, you know, this was written, it seemed like this was a good idea, and it was written, of course, by Rodgers and Hammerstein, and Hammerstein was a very liberal, open-minded man who was really, he had written other musicals like South Pacific, where he wrote songs like You've Got to Be Taught to Hate. I mean, he was a man who had some kind of political, and it was being expressed through these stories. So, but I didn't have any political leanings at all. I had an ambition to be a good dancer, and I, you know, progressed through the Hollywood system and the Broadway system, but I had, you know, very limited opportunities, but probably more than most people had because I had incredible training.
But early on, the illusion of equality busted wide open.
My first introduction to the fact that things were not equal was when I got a scholarship at my dance school, at American School of Dance, and the director of the academy said to me, in order for you to make a living as a dancer, you have to be twice as good as everybody else. I think I was 12 or 13. And that's when I started realizing, oh, this is... And he helped me a lot. He pushed me really hard to be better than other people, to give me the opportunities. But at the same time, I was really aware that it was not a level playing field.
Do you think that put more pressure on you as you were auditioning for?
Absolutely. And it put a lot more anger on me when I got rejected. Mm-hmm. And I really got a sort of a chip on my shoulder, you know, about, okay, I know I'm good. You're gonna say that I'm not gonna be able to have this job, you know? And I would go with an attitude, which was, but also gave me a lot of fire to be better, to be faster, to be ahead of myself. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. How often were you rejected?
Well, you know, often enough that, you know, you go to an audition for a television show, and they have to come up to you and say, well, you're a really good dancer, but you'll stick out. You know, stuff like that. You know, a few times. You don't need a lot of things like that. And then you know, within the dance world of the school and the performance that we did, there was no discrimination. I had an equal chance. I did a lot of really good roles. But as men and I stepped out into the system, into the show business system, then I became very aware that there were really big limitations, and that, you know, and as an actor, when I started going out for acting roles, it was so infuriating to be subjected to, oh, can you do this accent, or, you know, you can't cut your hair, you need to have long hair, and things like that. I mean, just expectations of what we should look like. And that made me actually want to look different and be different. So I didn't get a lot of, you know, into that, the groove of what some other people were acting roles, because I just didn't feel like cooperating.
In and around the time of the filming and casting of West Side Story, the color line, as Nobuko calls it, was a dichotomy between white and non-white, which is why she was cast as an Asian American to play a Latina role Well, at least in hindsight, this is neither hard to tell nor surprising. Heather Wood, for example, who plays Maria in the film adaptation of the musical, is of Russian ancestry, and in my opinion is a dead giveaway by the overcommitted rolling of the R's with British-sounding vowels. Maybe that's just me. Some actors and dancers cast as sharks or Puerto Ricans actually had brown face applied to look more the part if they weren't brown enough naturally. On the other hand, actors and dancers with light eyes, hair, or complexion were almost automatically Jets, or belonging to the white gang, in other words. But for Nobuko, landing a role that was anything but a gross stereotype of a generic Asian role was, in itself, refreshing.
And but when I did West Side Story, the movie, I had always wanted to cross the color line, and I was always frustrated that I couldn't. You know, why couldn't I do other kinds of things other than just being an Asian, just being Oriental? And West Side Story was the first time I really got a chance to pass for Puerto Rican. And that was really fulfilling for me. But then after that, it was like, okay, what do I do now?
Shortly after West Side Story, Nobuko was living in New York when, through a chance connection with a filmmaker, she found herself in the same spaces as some radical organizers and activists like Yuri Kochiyama. Kochiyama was a prominent ally to the Black Panther Party and is known as a dear friend to Malcolm X, having received postcards from him while he traveled in Africa and to Mecca, and even more famously that Malcolm X died in Yuri Kochiyama's arms after being shot. Nobuko explains more about how she entered that scene.
And I met someone introduced me to this Italian filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, Antonello Branca, who was making a film eventually about the Black Panthers. So my entrance into any kind of a movement was really through the seeing what was going on in the Black Panthers and realizing the Black Panthers sort of reflecting back on me, and they understood, you know, that Japanese Americans had been in concentration camps and, you know, they were oppressed minority in this country. So that's how I entered the movement. And that, and actually while filming that, I met Yuri Kochiyama and walked into this world where there were radical Japanese and Chinese Americans, and some of them were elders. They were in their 40s. I thought they were elders. and who had been communists and who had, you know, very progressive values. You know, it was strange for me because my parents were very, you know, kept their mouth shut and kept their head down and wanted us to get ahead. And they weren't looking at the system or thinking about if they could change the system like these other people were. So me and my brother both were involved, very involved in the first, you know, protesting against the war, helping mount, you know, demonstrations and marches and things like that. And then Warren Furutani came to New York, and he wanted us to come to this meeting of the JACL in Chicago. This is the summer of 1970 to push the JACL to take a position against the Vietnam War. And that's when activists from California and the East Coast came together in Chicago. And Grace Lee Boggs was there. It was quite an amazing gathering to realize. That was when we realized we were a movement. We weren't just these scattered little groups doing things in communities and so forth. We were, this was coast to coast, we were a movement. And there were people that were thinking, you know, in a very radical, big way of how we were going to change our world. So it was, that was really what, and we had met, Chris and I met the Panther. Chris and I and others met the Black Panthers right after Fred DeHampton was killed in Chicago. we walked and we met Native Americans who were protesting against for better housing and took us in like we were brothers and sisters. And then that night, Chris brought out his guitar, and I didn't even know he was a guitar player, and he could sing, and the brother could sing, and he started doodling and started making a song, and then he didn't know really that I sang, and we just both started singing, and it was late at night, hardly anybody was around, and we started working on this. I think Warren was there, and then it was decided that we would sing this song the next day for the conference. And when we sang, it was a moment, because the reality was we had never had our own song. No. Here we were, two Asians standing up in front of our community, elders and younger people, and we were singing our first song. Just look at my children walking hand in hand. You look at my children walking hand in hand. Have you ever woken just before the day is broken and wondered why you're feeling alone? Have you ever eaten, finished with your meat, and then watched the dogs all fighting for the bone? By yourself, you are just by yourself. Together we can all take a stand. By yourself, you are just by yourself. Just look at my children walking hand in hand.
And so Chrissy Jima and Nobuko Miyamoto were part of a budding activist group at the time called Asian Americans for Action. And it was actually started in part by Kazui Jima, who's Chris's mother in New York City. And so they were kind of the East Coast Asian American activists at the time. And they kind of used their music as a vehicle for spreading around what the Asian American movement was at the time. And so they would perform in different university campuses and probably church basements and local activist meetings and stuff like that. And they were performing groups in that sense. So the illustration is basically showing them in their heyday, in their youth. And I didn't necessarily draw the audience of it, but the audience, you know, was the built-in audience for them at the time was the young budding activists at the time that were learning about the Asian American movement and learning about the Third World Liberation and the anti-Vietnam protests and things like that. So basically songs of resistance.
I don't even remember, but it was amazing. And it wasn't only that they were reacting to it, they were part of it at the end. We got them involved in it. So it was like, it was a people's song.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a great song. You know, we wrote it in, you know, a couple hours. But it was called The People's Beat. It was based on Fred Hampton saying, you know, listen to the people's beat. We wanted to see what was going on the West Coast. So we went back to New York and we wrote a few more songs, including We Are the Children, The Yellow Pearl, you know, sort of core of a few songs we wrote. And then we sang some Dylan songs and some Beatles songs, and we did a benefit just to raise enough money to get us to California. And once we were in California, then Warren in Los Angeles, Jeff Morey in the Bay Area, they had arranged this whole tour of Los Angeles, Fresno, Sacramento, San Francisco, and we got to see with our own eyes. So Stockton, California, we got to see the Asian American movement in a much more spread out and community-based movement that we didn't have in New York, because it's small, you know, it's a total different terrain in New York. So that was the beginning, and when we went back to New York, we began to make frequent trips to the West Coast and around the country then, because people had never seen troubadours that were Asian Americans. All we needed was a couple guitars and voices. We didn't need a band. So, and we wanted to keep it simple because it meant that we could be more mobile. We could do it whenever people called for us to do it. Just all we had to do was pick up a guitar and the two of us would be there. And then eventually we hooked up with Charlie Chin.
Father, mother, sister, and brother. Father, mother, sister, and brother. Father, mother, sister, and brother. Take a stand, need a land. Ooh, you've got to take a stand.
Hey, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Pacific Underground's telling of the story behind Yellow Pearl, which is the first ever band of Asian Americans from the 1970s. You've been hearing from Nobuko Miyamoto, singer and lyricist from Yellow Pearl, as well as Portland artist, zinester, and librarian Amisa Chu. Before we get back to the show, I just want to show all of you a clip from Yellow Pearl. This is taken from a live shooting of Chris Ijima and Nobuko. Nobuko went by Joanna at the time, and this is on the Chris Douglas Show in 1972. Being introduced by a racist-sounding, or at least insensitive, John Lennon and Yoko Ono, who is so not audible on the clip.
First introduction to nationwide television, John.
Yeah. These are two young people that they call themselves Yellow Pearl. Their grandparents were Japanese, I guess, and they're young singers called Chris and Joanna, and beautiful singers, and they have a story to tell. They're going to come on now and do it. Here they are, Yellow Pearl.
Usually, people know very little about Asians, and this is a song about our movement, about our people's plight in America.
We are the children of a migrant worker. We are the offspring of the concentration camp. Sons and daughters of the railroad builder.
People call us Yellow Pearl, but we didn't call ourselves Yellow Pearl.
What did you think of yourselves as?
Well, we knew that we had stumbled onto something powerful that we could say with music and words. We could do something that a speech couldn't do. We wanted it to be more than propaganda. We wanted it to be musically good and have the funk and not necessarily be a sing-along song, but a song that would stand up on its own, because that's the kind of music we liked. We wanted to play the kind of music we liked. And at that time, folk music was really big, but we were listening to all kind of music. And just because we play it was guitars and voices, it didn't mean that it couldn't be a quality song. And I think that it amazes me, actually, now that some of these songs I can still sing today, and I think it stands up pretty well. And if we had, you know, one of the things we realized at that time, that Asian Americans didn't have their own music. We knew we were an arm or a voice for the movement, for the Asian American movement. It was very intentional. But when we were also ambassadors across the color line, because Latinos, we were engaged in work with political groups that were Latino and also Black. Especially, though, in my neighborhood in New York City, there was a squatters movement that we were very active in, and they helped us get an office, a drop-in center for Asian Americans in New York's West Side.
After hearing about Nobuko's experience tying music in with community, we wanted to ask Amisa about what her intentions were with her artwork in terms of the communal impact and how she wanted it to be engaged. We started out by asking her what the impetus was behind creating a body of work about old guard activists.
Was it our current political climate, or when did you actually draw that?
I drew it recently. Post-election, I've been thinking a lot about our resilience, so as in like particularly Asian Americans or just Asian APIs in general, and the resilience of our community. And I was thinking about the elders in the community, the activist elders, and I was also thinking about how am I as an individual going to move forward post-election, and what am I going to do, and how am I going to... Previously I was a little bit uncomfortable with considering myself an activist because I didn't feel active. But now I feel like I'm starting to kind of claim that identity for myself as I become more active in the Portland activist community. And so for me, it's just another way of inserting myself into the narrative, but also kind of trying to bridge the current activists with kind of elder movement leaders. And so this illustration is like part of a larger project that I'm working on, illustration project that I'm working on, documenting photographs of of the elders of different movements. And so focusing on Asian activist elders. And so I'm going to be drawing Grace Lee Boggs, for instance, and Yuri Kochiyama, and especially trying to draw Asian leaders who were very much a part and parcel of Black liberation as well. So Grace Lee Boggs and her husband Jimmy Boggs were in Detroit at the time, and then Yuri Kochiyama worked extensively in Harlem, partnering with folks like Malcolm X and Black Muslims at the time. And so kind of trying to depict these Asians and in their solidarity, and showing Asian solidarity with the Black community, that it's not something that's something new, but something that has been happening over time. And just trying to reveal that to people that maybe don't know about it. I'm starting off with known images, and so I'm starting off documenting known images, and then I'm going to kind of advance into recreating images. And so one of the images that I'm currently working on recreating is that Yuri Kochiyama, her and her large family had a two-bedroom apartment in Harlem, in some of the Harlem projects. And so they would have open houses, or like every weekend they would have an open door policy for activists and community leaders to come and have dialogue and conversation and eat as well. And so I was listening to there was a panel at the Japanese American Museum back in the day with Aiko Hirsik Yoshinaga, who is a historian activist in LA, but at the time was in New York. And her young daughter at the time, Lisa Furutani, who is married to Warren Furutani, who is a politician in Los Angeles, they were talking about participating in Yuri Kochiyama's kind of open house activist dialogues. And they were saying that tons of people would come into this two-bedroom apartment every week to kind of commune together, break bread together. And Lisa Furutani told the story about that she was very young at the time and was very intimidated by the activist community. And so what she knew how to do was serve the rice. And so she got behind the kitchen counter or whatever and served gohan with, you know, and that was like how she kind of found her place within the activist community, because it was something that was culturally acceptable for her to, like, she knew how to do. And while maybe the activist scene was something that she didn't know how to do, she knew how to serve the rice, and that's how she would participating. So I kind of want to start dialoguing with people. It's like, well, maybe you don't know what to do as an activist. Maybe the activist scene is really intense for you and you feel intimidated. What can you do that you're comfortable with that you can start participating in a sense. You know, can you hand out programs, or can you give someone a ride, or can you serve the rice at a meeting, or, you know, can you take notes, or, you know, what are some of the things that are accessible for people that are not necessarily, don't see themselves as like the leader of the group. They don't see themselves as the facilitator of the conversation, but something they still want to participate. So I think that this art project is moving in a direction to challenge the people that want to participate in the current movement, and encourage them that, like, even the small things are definitely things that still matter.
So then, is your art then? Well, because you're saying that, you know, up until recently you haven't considered yourself an activist because you haven't been active.
Mm-hmm.
So is your art like your small role or your activism? Is it kind of like your rice?
Yeah, maybe. I was always doing art, but it was definitely more a little bit more surreal and sci-fi based. And I've always wanted to do, and I've been doing more personal zines about my family and my upbringing, and like me being fourth generation Japanese American, and talking about, you know, my grandparents and their experiences in the concentration camps. And so I've been starting to do that even pre-election, maybe this year. I do feel like the art is definitely something that I'm going to be using more as a tool, I guess. But also I guess I didn't see myself as an activist because I wasn't necessarily, I didn't have time for a lot of it. And so I was, at the time I was having a daughter, I had a young child, and I was stuck at home with this baby. And so it really like hindered me from like going out to meetings and like hanging out, right? Like how I used to previously do. And so I had a couple of years to kind of stew and think about what I wanted to do. And it took a long time for me to like start producing artwork that was maybe art that could be used by the community and teaching tools other than just like escapism art. Cause a lot of my art is definitely like more along the lines of like weirdo art, alien landscapes and stuff like that. So this is some of the first art that I'm doing that is based on in reality and could be used like in terms of education and things like that. It's definitely aimed, so it's more of like an arrow. It's definitely aimed at a specific community. Like I'm talking about, you know, API movement elders, and so it's definitely very specific. It's not necessarily, the audience I think could be expanded beyond APIs, definitely, because definitely I want my art to be seen by the Black community and the bigger POC community as well, and be inspired by the dialogue that has been happening between different racial communities. But It has inspired a lot more thinking on my part. Like as I'm drawing the images, I'm definitely doing a lot of contemplation, and I feel like it's heavier. So I'm feeling like there's a lot more responsibility in these images. Like I'm just not half-heartedly drawing these images. Like I sit with them and I do a lot of research, and I don't really draw the images until I like have read up enough about the players that I'm drawing. Like, you know, I'm not just doing it as like an image. It's definitely, these are people that have influenced my life. Even if I haven't met them, they play a large role in terms of who I am now and who, what I want to teach, you know, say like the younger generation, and who I want my daughter to grow up with posters around our house of, you know? So I think it comes out of a place where it's like, if I wanted a poster of say, Yuri Kuchiyama, is it going to be easy for me to find a hand-drawn poster of this person, or is it going to be kind of difficult and there's not very many options? And so I think these projects are kind of out of that need for myself, even to be like, well, if I want to give my little nephew a drawing of Chrissy Jima, does it exist? And then it doesn't. So it's like, I have to do it. And so it's a little bit like of my responsibility as an artist, and something that I want to like encourage other artists to do too. It's like, we need these images to document this history. And I think myself as a librarian and archivist, it's like, I understand that if it's not being created, then it doesn't exist. So it has to be created. It's almost like our responsibility now to create these images, and for artists of different communities to create their own images for themselves, because if they don't draw them or they don't write about them, then maybe the mainstream media isn't paying attention, and that's a travesty, you know.
And we never recorded for a major record label. We recorded for Paradón Records, which was a small political label, and although, you know, the Smithsonian Institute recognized this work and we were part of this collection of political music, it was not widely distributed or promoted. And there was a strong cultural movement, if not just music, but films, the newspapers, Ghidra, both in California and Los Angeles, all up and down California, there were musical and visual arts posters. It was a lot of expressions of different kinds, poetry, books. I mean, you know, when we first started, there were, you know, you could hold an amount of books written about Asian America in one hand. But by the time 3 years had gone by and Amerasia Bookstore was there, they had filled a whole bookstore, you know. So there was a lot of expression but most of it was off the grid. It was sort of intentional. We didn't want to become part of the system. We tried to do it, create an alternative to what existed, instead of trying to get into the system and push the system to accept us as a, you know, an American expression, an American expression. So it didn't have that kind of exposure. And also, you know, it takes layers and layers. A culture is not made by one person, except maybe Bruce Lee.
I already mentioned Yuri Kochiyama as a sort of mentor of Nobuko's when she was first getting involved in activism in the New York City area. She was the one who organized with East Coast Black Panther chapters and was very close with Malcolm X. Amisa told us that she was fortunate enough to work with Aiko Herzeg Yoshinaga, another Japanese-American activist that was instrumental in uncovering formerly classified government information from World War II during the period when hundreds of thousands of Japanese Americans were interned. From her tireless research, she made discoveries that were instrumental in securing reparations for Japanese Americans, which happened ultimately in 1988.
I mean, when I was working with Aiko Herzeg Yoshinaga through UCLA, I was at her house, you know, for every day for 2 years working on what she was originally hired to do by the Commission of Wartime Relocation and Internment. And she had to document all these interviews that happened in the 80s that resulted in redress and reparations. And she was known as being, you know, one of the angrier women in the Japanese American community. And that probably a lot of the community was like, why are you so angry? But I feel like the anger is justified. And my question to the people that were like angry at her for being angry is like, why aren't you angrier? You know? And that has been one of the main questions I've had for my own family and community. It's like, why weren't we angrier? Or like, so you sacrificed, like you forgot about your anger. So like, it's like, you know, my parents were straight out of, you know, Berkeley in the 70s, Asian American movement. They were right there, you know, because they were going to school in the Bay Area and living in the Bay Area at the time. And then, you know, and everyone just like forgot about it as they started having kids and, you know, careers and like their middle class lives, you know, and then we just moved on. But I don't think we did move on. And I think all of this trauma catches up with you at some point.
And
I feel like the Yonsei and Gosei generation, but especially the Yonsei generation, has, like, I don't want to call it an opportunity, but I think more than the generations before us, we have the most space to have the conversations that couldn't happen before us.
Yeah.
And because we have kind of like enough space from it, that, like, at least time.
Right.
And we also live in a time where we're allowed to ask questions.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And we're actually allowed to, like, acknowledge emotions and trauma and pain. And so I really hope that more people of the Yonsei generation, and as they're raising the Gosei generation, you know, I don't know, kind of are willing to dive in and not continue that cycle of, like, well, let's just suppress this, or, oh, we're okay, and just be willing to do the hard work for a little bit. I don't know, to sort of address what I think so many generations before us were just never allowed to do.
Yeah, like, I mean, we're strong, resilient people, but it's okay, you know, all the sayings, you know, that Japanese Americans have for themselves, you know, like, don't be the nail that sticks out, be the nail that sticks out, or, you know, shigata ganai, like, it's okay to, like, cry sometimes. So, yeah, I definitely feel like I've pushed back on a lot of these things that I was raised with, where I was like, no, I won't shut up about it. No, I'm not going to stop crying about it. Like, I'm crying for all of you. And then I was like, well, I don't even know I'm sticking out. That was always my response. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm just, I'm so emotive that I'm like, I'm just trying to act on my emotions.
Here's Aiko Herzig Yoshinaga.
There was no way we could do it before. We didn't have the facts to begin with. Other things, we were so busy trying to rebuild our lives. We were afraid if they did it to us one time, what can they, you know, what's going to keep them from putting us away again if we start doing something like this? If your constitutional rights are so flagrantly violated, what kind of assurance is there that they're not going to do something like that again? The people still, I know, who still felt that way at that time in 1980, 81, 82. When you look through State Department records especially, you will discover that the State Department was very concerned about how Japanese Americans were treated here, because it would, Imperial Japan would find out about it, and they could mistreat prisoners of American who were Americans that they were holding. And so it would be a tit for tat situation. And the State Department was very interested and concerned that Japanese and Japanese nationals and Japanese Americans here be treated decently, so that there are Americans held by as prisoners and internees, civilian internees being held by Imperial Japan, would be treated decently. And so they would not have allowed, State Department would never have allowed, and therefore get word to Stimson, Secretary of War, never have allowed anything like that to happen. There is even a letter, I think, that Michi has published in her book, talking, it's a Stimson letter, talking about possible reprisals, threatening Japan that they could do something to us if they didn't treat Americans right. But there was a tremendous concern. So it would not have happened. In other words, the camps, we would not have been forcibly, by the point of bayonet, been forced into the camps. I'm positive of that.
Amisa also cites Grace Lee Boggs as another figure she plans to capture with her work. Nobuko also had the opportunity to work with the late, great Grace Lee Boggs. This is what she said about her time with her.
Because if we don't change ourselves, we can't change the world. If we only focus on something we don't like about the world, we're not going to really create something. I think this is something that Grace Boggs, who I consider a mentor, is really, you know, by soaking herself in the Detroit community, she learned and was able to apply in her own way to give leadership in different forms that have taken root.
We have to think in terms of how we are now in the midst of a cultural revolution whose ramifications are as profound as those from hunting and gathering 11,000 years ago to agriculture, and then from agriculture to industry a few hundred years ago. That's where we are on the clock of the human race. Defend ourselves against is to begin creating a new concept of hope, not to talk about recovery. We don't need to go back to a society that is concentrated on economic growth, that dehumanizes us, that makes us consumers only, and is threatening all life on this planet. We need to be thinking about something new.
We were thinking that's white people's problem. Well, hello. Who is being the most affected by global warming? It's people of color.
Right.
So now we're seeing this explosion. I mean, look at Standing Rock. Look at what's going on in Long Beach and these communities where the oil pollution is you know, permeating people's lives. There is very quickly a grassroots movement with a lot of ideological understanding of what they're doing. It's not just people rising up and they're also having ideas how they want change implemented. They're also building alternatives. So it's not enough to just protest. Then what is the alternative? And that's a longer story. That's a more difficult one, really, in a way. That first urge of crying out against injustice is an important and liberating moment. But then the hard work of putting our feet down on the ground and saying, okay, now, so what are we going to do? How do we want to live? How can we make this work better? So, yeah, you know, I think that culture really changes how we look at ourselves, how we identify ourselves. You know, you talked about, you know, being sort of benign, being quiet, being trying to be Americanized. How do we step out and say our culture is really cool, you know, and create and build on our cultures and continue to engage people? That's one of the reasons why I'm involved with Obon and also a community center like Sanjin Buddhist Temple, which I've been at for almost 40 years now. It's given me a space. And I'm rubbing my you know, my elbows next to the community. I'm part of it. I'm immersed in that community.
Definitely going back to Nobuko and Chris, it's like after I watched A Song for Ourselves, the documentary on Chrissy Jima's life, I was so moved and changed by how they used the music. I think what they said is like the music was a vehicle for change, and they just rode the wave, you know? And so it's like, that was so powerful for me that they weren't trying to make money off it. They weren't trying to be famous. They definitely had a message and they were just trying to share it. And I think that that's very similar to like my perspectives on this new project that I'm doing, documenting, you know, resistance elders. Oh, I've been definitely kind of gleaning off Mine Okubo's art lately. She was a comic book artist that documented the concentration camps during World War II, and so she did a first-hand journal account in comic book style of kind of her experience living in Manzanar, and that has been pretty powerful for me. I just got hired by Know Your City to do the Oregon History comic on Japanese incarceration. And so I'm working with writer Troy Matsuura, and we're going to be working on the Japanese incarceration comic coming out in 2017. Like, a lot of our family issues stem directly from the internment incarceration camps directly. And so it's still here and it's not going away. And if other communities are in, you know, basically getting threatened by this, it's like, it will affect them for generations to come, and maybe already are affecting them, you know? And so, yeah, I definitely feel like that is something that needs to happen sooner than later.
It's people have to move in the ways that they can move the best. If it's music, if it's poetry, if it's organizing, if it's being medicine, whatever it is, you've got to move. I would like to see eco-villages. I would like to see villages with elder artists and architects and young people coming together and figuring out new ways of living, creating spaces together, passing wisdom along so that the generations can intermix.
Well, that's the end of our show. You've been listening to Pacific Underground. Pacific Underground is me, Kanan Schlesinger, Tabitha Teo, and Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to our guest, my aunt Nobuko Miyamoto, and Amisa Chu. Also, big thank you to Sam, our engineer. Another special thanks to DiscoverNikkei.org and Densho Encyclopedia for research resources. To find the music you've been hearing throughout this episode, you must go to either search.alexanderstreet.com to use your library card information to stream it for free online, or go to the Smithsonian Folk website or Folk Smithsonian website to purchase a digital or physical copy, or maybe stream it on Spotify. I'm not sure if it's available there in its entirety. Please subscribe to our podcast to get all of our latest audio. Find us on iTunes and SoundCloud at Pacific Underground. Check out our Facebook and Twitter at PAC Underground, and check out our website at pacificunderground.org. Pacific Underground is a production of KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Thank you, Chops, for our abbreviated music this month, and thank you to KBOO's AM News and Public Affairs Director, Derek Crooks, and to KBOO Community Radio for the studio space, love, and support. We'll see you next month.
Brothers and sisters all around the world, we are a part of the third world people who will leave their stamp on America.
Oh yeah, and about to leave his stamp on your ear bones is Mr. Don Jacobson. He's going to be bringing you 90 minutes of Moving On. That's going to occur in just a little over 2 minutes. Because right now it's 11:57 a.m. We've got a couple of important community announcements. The news headlines at noon. And as mentioned, Moving On with your host, the one and only, the inimitable, the non-inimical, an all-around mensch, as I said, Don Jacobson. That's all coming up on your community radio, which means it is your responsibility to keep it strong, fierce, and independent with your membership in the KBOO Foundation. You can do that right now online at kboo.fm/give or through the Willamette Week's Give Guide site. That'll guide you through it, hence the term guide. And you'll have an opportunity to do so in a more festive, more coming together block party kind of feel soon. In fact, beginning next Tuesday, November 28th. More on that later. For now, this.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Give Guide Media Access Team Happy Hour, Wednesday, November 29th at 5 p.m. at the White Owl Social Club in Portland. KBOO partnering with media organizations Friends of Noise, Open Signal, and X-Ray to host the Give Guys Happy Hour at White Owl Social Club. Enjoy performances by Riva DeVito and local DJs, and celebrate spaces where we can share our own stories in our own words with the Give Guide Media Access Team. Again, that's the Give Guide Media Access Team Happy Hour, Wednesday, November 29th at 5 p.m. at the White Owl Social Club at 1305 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hats for the Homeless donation drive. From December 1st through the 15th, five Southeast locations will collect clean, new, or gently used hats, scarves, and gloves, and the folks at Zippity News will distribute them to local shelters. Dropbox locations and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, November 24th, 2017. In the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt this morning, at least 234 people were killed in an explosion at a mosque. At least 100 people were injured, both in the initial explosion and in other explosions targeting ambulances that arrived at the mosque to take away the wounded. The Ansar Beit al-Maqdis group claimed responsibility for the attack. That group is associated with Daesh, known in English by the acronym ISIS. This kind of attack on civilians